your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to start off this hour with a speech given by Steve Bannon to the Union, to the Oxford Union Society, around November 5th, I believe, of this year, 2018. And it's really interesting. One of their mottos is there around this particular union society is people who shape our world. So they invite people from all over the world to speak to them. And they invited Steve Bannon to speak recently, just within 2 weeks ago, to the society. The actual motto of the University of Oxford is "The Lord is my light." So here we go with Steve Bannon, and he hits them, God, right between the eyes, and he tells you elites, y'all are the trouble. Here we go now.
Thank you. And thank you for coming to this night, having to work your way through it. I think you've seen the supporters of free speech out there. What I want you to do tonight is see or listen to why this is so dangerous. Because it is against the established order. It's against the established way things are. And I think that's what frightens people. I think it's what scares people. And so here tonight, ask me questions. I'll take any question you've got. Let's go back to the beginning. Because remember, this populist movement and Donald Trump is not the cause of this. They're the product of this. September 18th, 2008, the Oval Office. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, Secretary of Treasury Hank Paulson, a guy who used to work for Goldman Sachs, walk into the Oval Office a couple of days after Lehman Brothers was put into bankruptcy in London. They tell him, by 5 o'clock tonight, we need $1 trillion in cash. $1 trillion in cash, or the American financial system is going to implode in 48 hours. The world financial system will implode in 72 hours. And in 2 weeks, we'll have global anarchy and chaos. Let me repeat that. Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson are not, they're not given their hyperbole. Very low-key, very professional people in finance. $1 trillion by the close of business. Or the American financial system, the British financial system, the EU, the Bank of Tokyo, all of it will come down in 4 or 5 days. They accomplished what Kaiser Wilhelm and the Japanese military junta and Mussolini and Hitler and Mao Zedong and the Soviets and Stalin, all of them, Osama bin Laden, they accomplished what the Judeo-Christian West greatest enemies could not. Now, how did that happen? It was the elites and people like you and me, people that bought into the system. And who's been held accountable? Name me one banker, one CEO, one law firm, one accounting firm. No equity's been taken. No bonuses were actually really deferred. How did we get out of this? The most progressive president in the history of our country, Barack Obama, agreed to. The balance sheet of the Federal Reserve that day was $880 billion. The balance sheet on the day that Donald Trump raised his hand was $4.5 trillion. Here's what we did. We basically just flooded the zone with liquidity. We bailed out the party of Davos. Now, let me say it differently. The party at Davos, the scientific, engineering, managerial, financial, cultural elite, with their political employees, the permanent political class, bail themselves out. It's not a free bailout. I think today it's $41 trillion of debt to central governments. It has a corollary in your life. Remember, these are all in the minutes. It's in the minutes of the congressional hearings, in the minutes of the Federal Reserve, in the minutes of the Bank of England. They said at the time, hey, this is going to cause interest rates to go to zero. So the 2,500 or 3,000 years of the Judeo-Christian West, we taught the good householder to save, you get zero. You're a sucker. You have a savings account, you're a sucker. The pension funds have the biggest gap. The pension plans have the biggest gap in history, getting worse. Why? You can't get returns on the pensions. You can't do a public bond offering in the United States to fix a school or to build a water system. Why? There's not enough juice in the offering. We basically socialize the risk for the wealthy. If you've owned intellectual property, real assets or stocks in the last 10, 15, or 20 years, since the collapse in 2008, you've had the greatest run in human history. And yet in the United States, 50% of our population can't put together $400 of cash in an emergency. 62% of the jobs that were created before President Trump got there were jobs that living wage or below living wage. And living wage means no extras, no holidays, nothing for the kids. It means basically subsistence. It is the cause. The elite in this world are the cause of the problem, not the populace, and certainly not Donald Trump. When I stepped into the campaign in mid-August, he was down, I don't know, 12, 14, 16 points. You know, double digits down every battleground state. I said, none of those numbers matter. There's only two numbers matter, right track, wrong track. The country still thought it was on the wrong track. They admired President Obama. They admired President Obama and his wife. But they did not feel that he had brought the change the country needed. More importantly, Pat Caddell had been doing research for 20 or 30 years. I said, the American working class, the American middle class, for the first time in our history, 70% felt the country was in decline, and the elites were comfortable with this. The elites were comfortable with the managed decline, not just of the United States, but the West. I said, it's very simple. We're just going to do a compare and contrast. She is a guardian of a corrupt and incompetent elite. And you're the tribune of the people, the agent of change. And we're just going to hammer that every day. And that's what took us to victory. Remember, in the United States, since 2000, the deplorables were created. What were they? How was the deplorables? How is this working class, this angry working class, how was it created? We had three extinction-level events. Number one, the rise of China. The deindustrialization of our country. All the shipping of the jobs to East Asia, the high-value added manufacturing jobs. If you read Hillbilly Elegies, the great sociological study of the Trump deplorables by J.D. Vance from Yale. He says there's a direct correlation between the factories that went to China, the jobs that went with them, and the opioid crisis. Tariffs, this trade war is not about tariffs. It's not about taxes. It's not about tariffs on goods. It's about human dignity and self-worth. It's about bringing manufacturing jobs back to the United States. It's the reason Brexit and 2016 are inextricably linked. And we can see when Brexit happened that gave the grassroots and the little guy some sense of hope that you could defeat the system. The second extension, and by the way, we were told the whole time by the elites, the rise of China, and this is not about the Chinese people, this is about the Chinese Communist Party, that the rise of China was a second law of thermodynamics. It was physics. That you couldn't change, nothing you could change. And they were just dead wrong. Everything they said about that was absolutely dead wrong. The second extinction level event is the $7 trillion we spent on these wars in the Middle East. Now, I'm a former naval officer. My daughter is a West Point grad, fought with the 101st Airborne in Iraq. You know, I'm as much a militarist as any right winger. But $7 trillion. And this is not Breitbart, this is not Bannon, this is the Watson Center at Brown University. $7 trillion on two wars that we didn't win. and didn't accomplish our objectives, and we're still spending $62 billion a year in Afghanistan. And the third is the financial crisis brought about by a financial elite that's never been held accountable. I think of the 250 criminal referrals from all the studies and all the commissions. The Obama Justice Department never moved on any of them. That is what caused the populist revolt. And look at what our solutions were. Economic nationalism, American First national security policy, and the deconstruction of the administrative state. You have right-wing populism and you have left-wing populism. And the difference, and I wish our dear friends out here understood fascism. Fascism is the worship of the state. Fascism is that combination of state crony capitalism and big government. It's exactly what we're trying to fight. It's where the United States is going as an economic system. More and more concentration by media companies, by pharmaceutical companies, by industrial companies, by tech companies, along with their partners in big government. So Trump ran on three basic stuff. We're going to stop mass illegal immigration and limit legal immigration to get our sovereignty back, and more important, to protect our workers, to protect the Hispanic and African-American working class at the low end of the scale, and the Hispanic and African-American that aspire into the tech industry along with others at the high scale. We're still going to have immigration, but we're going to limit it. Because economic nationalism doesn't care about your color, your ethnicity, your religion, your gender, your sexual preference. What it cares about is that you're a citizen. A citizen gets a better deal. Remember the mantra on Wall Street that I learned at Harvard Business School. The mantra that got us into this situation is the maximization of shareholder value. That became a fetish. There are no other stakeholders. It's the maximization of shareholder value. Economic nationalism is about the maximization of citizenship value. And look at what Trump does at the beginning. What does he do? He engages, remember, it's immigration and trade. Trade and immigration are two sides of the same coin. All bad trade deals is unfair competition of labor in lower cost countries against your labor. And what does Trump do? Immediately starts the NAFTA deal. Why? Because NAFTA is the centerpiece in this economic war with China. You've got to bring back the supply chain to the industrial West. That's why Korea's doing a deal. That's why Japan's doing a deal. And that's why the EU is doing a deal. Because we're shifting the supply chain, high value added manufacturing jobs back to the West. We're reindustrializing what was deindustrialized. Remember, because of what the elites have done in the financial system, with this over-leverage and an increase in asset value, it's made the millennials, it's made Generation Z, it's made you essentially Russian serfs. You know, you're better fed, you're better clothed, you're in better shape, you have more access to information, but you don't own anything, and you're not going to own anything. Why do you think it's so expensive in Silicon Valley, in New York, and in London? That is the flooding of the zone of liquidity. That is what's going to make your generation paupers. Right now, the statistics are brutal. You are 20% behind. People in their mid-20s, late 20s, 20% behind their parents' generation of where they are, and the gap's only going to get increased as far as wages go. And you don't own any assets. You're not going to own any assets. Only what's passed down, nothing that you earn yourself. You can't save because it's zero. You can't own any assets. You can't buy a house. The number one, every study shows the number one problem with family formation in the United States and the West, in 20s and 30s, is economic anxiety. People don't feel that they can have a job they depend on. I talk to audiences all over the world of middle-class people, and they all understand something. They're two paychecks away from oblivion, right? They don't really have a stake in the system. They're two paychecks away. And when you turn 50, it gets even worse. So economic nationalism is working. The compound annual growth rate of the United States economy from the end of World War II, 1946 or 47, to 1999, when China signed Most Favored Nation, came into the WTO, I think was 3.25 or 3.5%. Through ups and downs, recessions, but averaged about 3.5%. From that day forward until Trump raised his hand, the annual compound growth rate was 1.8%. Now, there were other things to do with that, too, but centrally is that investment in the West, in the industrialization process, went to China as we deindustrialized. It's one of the reasons the Brexit vote was a labor vote in the Midlands of England that pushed it over the top. That's what nobody polled. That's what nobody thought, is that the labor vote would push that over the top. The deindustrialized center of this country.
Did you notice he sets out better than anyone I've heard lately as to exactly what President Trump's goals are, really? Now, let me tell you something I think about Trump that not many people are aware of. Trump is a pragmatist, so he likes to get things done. So he's not always principled. He'll jump from side to side to accomplish something. One day he's blessing someone out. The next day he's calling them my old friend, you know. But he's trying to make deals. He's a deal maker. He's a wheeler dealer type of person, personality. Promoter, wheeler dealer. But he does get things done, and he works really hard in the Oval Office. So what we've got is that Steve Bannon lays out very succinctly about the money problem that originated in 2007, 2008, and how these Wall Street people came in there and hustled our president at the time to start bailing them out to the tune of billions of dollars. And it actually, they asked for $1 trillion is what it would take to do it. And that was forthcoming. And when that money was forthcoming, then, boy, they were saved. But until then, they were in a precarious situation. But it wasn't necessarily that we were in a major recession. But it was because it was a financial collapse of that many of these financial institutions had overextended themselves and were illiquid. And so to save the banking sector, then they went to the Fed. Then the Fed started printing money. You could say quantitative easing is what they started doing. And with quantitative easing, it saved them and pulled them out. Now, what we have going on right now is that Bannon is presenting President Trump's ideas along a, you could say, a populist, from a populist viewpoint for the people and for the country and for, you know, national security and so forth. America first, you know, like Trump ran them. But the opposition and the enemies of Trump, immediately when he declared that he was a populist or nationalist, see, the word nationalist is the hot button term that they started seizing upon the press and the media. And they started comparing Trump to Nazi, you know, Germany or Hitler or Mussolini and some of those strong men, or I've heard him call him a Stalin before and everything. But Trump is truly a populist, nationalist, you say, figure that deep down, Trump has a love for this country real deep down, but he's also a bit of a wheeler dealer promoter, and he's a pragmatist, so he'll jump from side to side to get things done. He'll compromise a little bit. He'll try to present scenarios back and forth to seduce people into his way of thinking. And so that's basically what I see going on. You know, they've all picked this up. Hillary has picked up this thing about nationalist, and they're all trying to categorize it as some dominant socialist, possibly fascist. They won't use that term, but they insinuate and they infer that he's a fascist leader and that he's building this fascist society in America. But Hillary and her gang, they exhibit more of these kinds of totalitarian characteristics than Trump does. Trump knows and that he can count on the people out there, the middle class people that see his job creation and so forth. Now, on the other side, you've got the media that's against him being manipulated by the insiders. But this speech by Steve Bannon set out that Trump is against the cream de la cream, against the elites and their system and their existing system. And that's why he wants major reform in the banking sector, in the Federal Reserve, and so forth. So they're presenting and mobilizing the rest through their elite ownership, the elite's ownership of the media and control of the bank, central bank, and things like that, they have mobilized a formidable force against Trump. And so that's why you're seeing him, you know, come under heavy fire. Here's another excerpt from that speech that Steve Bannon gave at Oxford recently. But listen carefully. He tells who they should shut down, and then tells that we should get out there. The Republicans did not get out and hustle those votes door to door like the Democrats did. Listen carefully.
They said, oh, it's European Parliament. Nobody cares. They're going to care next May. Because next May, and Donald Tusk so politely says it, that the brown shirts of the populist nationalist movement are going to be against the EU good guys like Macron. By the way, before I wrap up, Macron is a nationalist. He's a nationalist. But the capital of his nation is not in Paris. It's in Brussels. Right? Read his speech in 2017. He wants a United States of Europe. More commercial integration. More capital markets integration. More political integration. More military integration. It's Brussels is his capital, and that's not me saying it. The day after he insults President Trump to his face for the second time, because he did it in Congress the first, his finance minister comes up and says, hey, the EU should be an empire, his words, not mine, like China and the United States. That's what the EU wants. And last thing for open questions, as I've gone around on the movement now and met all the leaders in Europe, not one has ever mentioned destroying the EU. What they want is a reformed EU. They want a confederation of individual nation states that are governed by the citizens of those nation states and not be a United States of Europe. They don't want Italy to be Georgia, to France or South Carolina. I have a lot more to go through, but maybe we'll get to it in questions. Thank you so much.
Steve Bannon makes some good points, and he's saying that he's traveled around, you could say, the European Union states and talked to them, and he says that not a one has talked about destroying the European Union, but they want major reform. They want to go ahead and rule within their nation states, but they don't want to be under that iron thumb or iron hand of the Brussels centralized government. So what he's saying is very, very important, and we should pay attention to it. And the people there, the students and so forth attending this Oxford Union, you could say society speech, were very warm to what Steve Bannon was saying. And so he must be listened to, because he's touching base with a lot of people. And he says that Macron is a nationalist, but he's a nationalist for the European Union, not France. And today, let me read a few excerpts here from a newspaper reports just recently in Paris. They've been burning on Champs-Élysées. They've been burning fires along the major boulevard there, and France is in an uproar about gas prices, gasoline for cars. And so listen to these excerpts just a second. It's being reported that the police locked horns with thousands of angry protesters in Paris, who stormed the streets with placards, wearing yellow vests, before hurling objects at riot police and starting fires. There were images they were putting out. The Express News in UK had people on the ground. There were videos and so forth, and photographical evidence of examples of these crowds. And they're wearing these yellow vests in protest of the gasoline prices. Said a trailer was set on fire, exploded on the Champs-Élysées, and a man who tried to attack firefighters was overpowered by some of the demonstrators themselves. So they're trying to downplay the violence somewhat, but it is going on, and they're burning vehicles and turning them over and so forth right in France. It said a poll this week indicated that 73% of people in France have expressed support for the protest, which have been characterized as a grassroots movement lacking in clear leadership. It's just a grassroots. Mr. Macron admitted failing to reconcile the French with their leaders and had not given them enough consideration, but is standing firm and refusing to back the fuel taxes. Standing firm and refusing to back the fuel prices. Interior Minister Christopher Castaner accused far-right leader Marine Le Pen of fanning the protests in the capital. He said the ultra-right is mobilized and building barricades on the Champs-Élysées zones. They are progressively being neutralized and pushed back by police. In a message to Twitter, Le Pen said she had questioned why no protests were being allowed in the area. She said, "Today Mr. Castaner is using this to target me. This is low and dishonest." So, you know, there's riots going on in Paris over fuel prices. And Macron is, he's, according to Steve Bannon and others, he cares more about the European Union than he does France. And the people are hurting over there in France, and they're beginning to, you know, push back against prices and taxes and things like that. So that's what's really going on. In additional news today, it's been reported that Republican Mark Meadows, Republican North Carolina, said Tuesday that House Republicans plan to hear testimony on December 5th from the prosecutor appointed by former Attorney General Jeff Sessions to probe alleged wrongdoing by the Clinton Foundation. Meadows, the chairman of the House Oversight Committee on Government Operations, told Hill TV Rising that it's time to circle back to U.S. Attorney General John Huber's investigation with the Justice Department into whether the Clinton Foundation engaged in improper activities. What we're going to see now is that since the Democrats control the House, that they'll be starting up all kinds of investigations, and they'll start torpedoing any of those scandalous investigations on those scandals that the Republicans had going. Some of the members of these former committee members of these holdover committees, you could say, membership, are saying that the Republicans didn't move quick enough on some of the testimony by Comey and other people. They should have gotten them in there sooner, but they didn't. They thought that maybe they would hold on to the House and those committees would go on, but it didn't happen. So we're seeing now there's going to be a compromise from both sides. And it just appears to me that the committees may not have the teeth that they had when they control the House also. That's when they really had the power. They had the president, and then they got the president to delay on declassifying some things. Now that the British and MI6 is pressuring, you know, Trump not to declassify anything, saying that the sources and means and methods, he could say, would be compromised, and they're trying to hustle him like that. So we see Pelosi possibly going in as House, Speaker of the House, and then they're going to use the House as a threat vehicle against Trump to back him off for some of these other investigations. That's what it appears that's going on right now. And so I don't see that we're going to be able to make much progress on that basis. He does have control of the Department of Justice, so he can bring charges and indictments against Hillary and things like that. But will they be, because if that's brought forward, will they come up with some kind of impeachment, try to get rid of Trump? Well, they possibly don't have the votes in the Senate, because they just need for an impeachment to begin. They only need a simple majority in the House to bring impeachment charges. Now, the actual trial is held in the Senate, presided over by the Chief Justice. A conviction, though, requires two-thirds of the Senate to vote for conviction. So, in normal situations where the normal Republican president had the support of a Republican party behind him, they would never be able to achieve the two-thirds. But this is a different situation. You've got rhinos in there. You've got never Trumpers in there. You've got the Republican Party that is against Trump along with their counterparts in the Democratic Party. So it's very possible in this case, this is a special, unique situation where they might be able to convict him, impeach him, and go to an impeachment charge and conviction of it, of those charges, and get him out. It's very possible that this could happen, and that's what makes this very dangerous for President Trump. In the meantime, he could always back off of some investigations that he has going against them, and thus they would back off against the impeachment. That's probably what I see that will occur. But what we're going to have is we're going to have a Mexican standoff now that the Democrats control the House. And so I don't think many of these investigations that were catching fire under previous, don't think it's going to come to fruition. So we're going to see a whole different setup. Well, here goes with another clip of next up is a discussion with Mark Levin and Victor Davis Hanson, and very, very insightful. It's about the transformation that has occurred and is ongoing in this country. So listen carefully.
That he was, at this point, we're at a point of no return, and he was the anecdote.
We're at a point of no return. You said existential threat.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, if we're, say we're the typical of conservative America, you and I, the 65 million that voted for Trump, we look around, it's like a soon opticon. We've got the NFL, NBA, Silicon Valley, Apple, Google, Facebook. We've got Rockefeller. We've got the Brookings Institution. We have cable TV, not just MSNBC and CNN, but the major networks as well. We have NPR. We have PBS. We have the progressive cultural movement.
Rap, academia.
Music. Academia is where I am. And we're surrounded, and we think that these institutions don't have as much clout as they do have, and then we get shocked every 4 years that the message just surrounds us, and nobody can. We don't have a mechanism for breaking through to the American people and getting a message. And the irony is, the message of free market capitalism, limited government, individual liberty is what they thrive for in their daily lives. They sometimes vote against their interests because this circular octopus, soon opticon, whatever you want to call it. We don't get any. You and I, conservatives, traditionalists, we have safe spaces, if I could use their word, where we retreat to. For them, it's a 24/7 relentless entertainment, education, politics, media, and it's overwhelming.
Do you think, the progressives, they wrote about this, that they basically needed to devour society, all these major institutions. Do you think they've largely succeeded?
I do. I think if you tomorrow, Mark Levin, go to Stanford and you give a lecture on global warming, I don't think you're going to be able to finish that lecture without being interrupted. I think if I go to Stanford or Harvard or Yale and give a lecture on the value of assimilation, integration, and intermarriage with measured legal meritocratic diverse immigration, I won't be able to finish that lecture. I think if I touch somebody in the shoulder and that person files a sexual harassment suit at me at a major corporation, I'm not going to be given due process. And that's besides the social chaos that we live in. I live in an area that's ground zero of illegal immigration, where the Norteños gang is fighting the M13 gang across the street. I'm talking about refined society. So I don't think due process, free speech, the right redress of grievances exist in major areas of American life, corporate, university, foundational life, media.
So you're saying what you've already seen, and I agree with it, the fundamental transformation of America gradually. Is it picking up speed now?
I think it is. I don't want to be pessimistic in the sense that I really admire you, and I admire people at Fox News. I admire people, some in the Republican Party, really brave voices there are in academia that are saying, I'm going to speak out regardless of the consequences. But the Romans and the Greeks believed that luxus, that's a more authors use, luxury, affluence, leads to non-seriousness. I don't want to use the word decadence, but we are such an affluent, leisured society. So somebody from the inner city can have an iPhone with more computing power than six IBM mainframes. A guy across the street can come from Mexico and he can be in a Kia, and that can be a better ride than a Mercedes 30 years ago. And I think that's great. But what we don't get with it is some collective gratitude or some sense of accomplishment. Instead, we get that Kia is not as good as today's Lexus, and therefore the equality result didn't work for me. And that I don't like the lack of gratitude or the trashing of the system or our ancestors that gave us all the system. And maybe it's the universities have created an arrogant and ignorant cadre of youth, but something's gone wrong.
Isn't this the issue about freedom generally? Freedom is a tremendous thing.
Yeah.
But it also gives opportunity for very evil people to use freedom to destroy freedom.
Yeah.
And isn't that what the framers of the Constitution tried to prevent? They were worried about mobocracy. They were worried about autocracy. And so they create this republic. And there's a constant attack at the foundational principles of the republic. President wins the Electoral College. They want to get rid of the Electoral College. The progressives don't like the fact that the Senate is representative of the state, so they get rid of that, and they have direct election of the senators. They want to get rid of other aspects, separation of powers. They keep building up this fourth branch, this administrative branch of government with 2 million people and growing. That's what they do. It isn't that an attack on our foundational principles, liberty.
Yeah, I think it is. I think they understand what the framers were up to. And their model is not a constitutional Rome that went through Europe through the Enlightenment with Montesquieu separate. It's radical Athenian democracy. On any given day, 51% of the population decide what the law is. There is no constitutional protection. You want to kill Socrates on Monday or murder the Melians on Tuesday, you can do it if you have 51%. So it's been steady. I mean, we went from property qualifications, moderate property, to direct election of senators, and there were some arguments for this. And then, as you say, now it's abolishing the Electoral College and enlarging the Supreme Court now, packing it, enlarging the House of Representatives, maybe 1,000 members. Why people in California say, why does Wyoming get 250,000 people get one senator and we 20 million get one? That's not fair. Let's turn the Senate into the House. But the long-term trajectory is government-mandated or sanctioned equality of result. Because they got what they wanted with the civil rights, finally. We had true equality of opportunity. And then they were expecting that everybody would be equal. And human nature being what it is, it's never going to be that way. So they said, or the conservative position is, we're not going to be equal, but the poorest person is going to have a pretty good life if he's in a free market economy and a constitutional system. But they say, no, we don't really care what absolute poverty or wealth is. We want everybody to be equal. They would rather have everybody making $20,000 a year than the poor making $50,000 and somebody making $1 billion. So that's relentless. That's a psychological...
That is a very, very important point that you mentioned. Equality, it's thrown around all the time.
Yeah.
Now, we know what the founders meant by equality. Equality of justice. They didn't mean equality of economics. Of course, that would be absurd because it's an impossibility. And human beings, we pride ourselves on unique. Human beings are unique individuals. Human beings are created by God. Human beings are one different from the other. But in the civil society, we argue that the law is the law and everybody should be treated as best as we can, equally in front of a court, in front of the law. But this notion of radical egalitarianism really is a European import.
Yeah.
Marx, Engels, Hegel, Rousseau, which is completely alien to our founders, isn't it?
It is, and it has some precedence in the ancient world. Aristotle, who was a critic of this, said once a man feels he's equal in one aspect, politics, he assumes he can be equal in every other aspect. Plato said the trajectory is that finally the donkeys and the dogs in Athens have to vote, meaning there will be a destruction of criterion. But you're right, it takes up speed in the Enlightenment in Europe, and it bifurcates. And we thought we were saved from it because the Anglo-Scottish tradition was more limited government, very deep skepticism of the cycles of the French Revolution. And the European continental model is a model that progressives choose. And they have a view that human nature is by nature, a Rousseauian view that we're born into chains, the church, the community, the family, and it's the duty of government to take off those chains and let everybody be liberated, and then they will naturally be happy, which is sort of our collective nightmare. But we're headed to a radical egalitarian society in aspects that transcend politics, almost every imaginable facet. And I just mentioned sports, culture, entertainment, movies. That's the message.
And they advance this notion, tell me if I'm right or wrong, of populism.
Yeah.
When in fact it's authoritarianism.
Yeah.
People believe that they've democratized some program, some issue, some aspect of society, when in fact it's not democratized at all. In fact, it is decisions from on high. The intellectual elites, which they're not really intellectual elites, but they like to think they are intellectual elites. And who are these intellectual elites? Why are they elites? Because they're elected? Because they're members of unions? Because they're in the civil service? I've never understood who these intellectual elites are and why they're so elite.
Well, they have a certain cachet. They think they went to a particular, they're branded like cattle. They think that the Ivy League brand allows them certain entree or certain privileges. But you look at Silicon Valley, you have gatekeepers that decide what is hate speech and what is not. And they control the expressions of 7 billion people on the planet because they are better, morally better than we are. You turn on public TV and you get this, or cable TV, and you get this anguish about, these people, or, you know, the deplorables, the irredeemables, the clingers. I think they used the term East Germans. I've heard that said. I think John McCain called them wacko birds and those people. So there was a real contempt for people they feel that don't properly know how to use their freedom and their economic clout, and they do stupid stuff. They buy jet skis, they go snowmobiling, and they pollute the universe. And if you can just have this international global elite that have proper education, proper resumes, proper CVs, sober and judicious, they can all get around and they can say, you know what, we're doing it all for you. And of course, throughout history, we've seen these people, and they all have one thing in common, that they're all excused, or they're not subject to the ramifications of their own ideology. So.
Mark Levine and Victor David Hansen were discussing the transformation that has occurred at major universities. There is a whole different mindset than just a few years ago. The closing of The American Mind by Alan Bloom way back several years ago sort of set the tone that the universities were moving away from teachings of humanities because of the criticism of Western thought and so forth. And they were moving to some more contemporary teachings, feminism and so forth. And what Mark Levine and them were talking about, in my opinion, it would be my interpretation, is that the universities then have been transformed into much more of a collective Marxist-Communist state. You see Bernie Sanders, when he was running for office during the last presidential campaign, had an amazingly great number of people turning out. And it's alleged and proven now that Hillary, you know, cut him to pieces on some of those primaries. So she cheated him out of some of the primaries. But Bernie Sanders lost a lot of support because people wanted him to stand up to Hillary's, manipulations using the Democratic Party to do her bidding. But the number of people that showed up gave us a red flag that a large number of people out here in the American society today want something. And they're willing to listen to someone that gets up and tells them free medical care, free education, free this, free that, and so forth. But the cost of all these things is very, very high taxes and a much stronger centralized statist government. and also a leveling down of your wages, some above subsistence levels and so forth. So if you go along, you got to get along, and then you're approved by the government, then you can get some benefits, entitlement programs. But if you're against the government and so forth, and you're wanting, you're screaming up there for free speech and all that, then they're going to come down on you and give you nothing. So that's basically the way it looks like it's beginning to come together out here. The prognosis for America is not good. We look around and we see a greater number of people, say, for example, in Texas, voting for Beto. And Beto was for sanctuary cities, open borders, gun control, and so forth. So he's an example of a very progressive, you could say, campaign and platform. But a lot of people, the younger people, responded to him. So that's what they're beginning to respond to, is that they spent, you know, decades in ecological training and global warming training, and that things are not equal, and that equal opportunity. They've been schooled in egalitarian type of system to produce one. And some people are saying, okay, we're going to level everybody down to some kind of a lower income type of thing, see. And that could very well be what we're going to see. We're seeing, you could say, rioting in Paris today. And it's really, that is a populist movement from what I can tell. They're sick and tired of the government just putting more and more taxes on gasoline prices and so forth, taxing them to death. So these people are these Frenchmen are out there, and they're not for this Brussels thing. I mean, they don't give a damn what Brussels does. They care about the money they have left in their pocket after they've paid all their expenses. And what's happening all over Europe is that you have populism, you have uprisings, very populist types of uprisings, and I think this one in Paris is just one example of what's going on out there. And people are getting sick and tired of this. Beijing wants to put everybody into behavior. You could say every resident based on behavior by end of 2020. They're not going to make it. I'm sorry. The Chinese are going to riot. They're not going to go for this. I just don't see them giving in to this. And Beijing, you know, had trouble on the Tiananmen Square back in 1989. There were riots there in Beijing and so forth. They had to bring an army in, some of these army units from Mongolia, to quell, you know, some of the demonstrations and so forth. So China is close to a riotous situation if the Chinese don't manage properly. And this thing about the Chinese using the internet to regulate people. The China's plan is to judge each of its 1.3 billion people based on their social behavior. And they're getting closer and closer to it. Recently, they've denied mass transport to people that didn't meet their social behavior levels and so forth. And they're just not going to, it's not going to work, I don't think. I think that they're overreaching, and the Chinese are going to push back. There's a whole lot more Chinese than there are, you could say, government people or army people or whatever. And I would just encourage the Chinese people to stand up to this and say, no, we're not going to go for this, and just deny the opportunity or the, you know, of the government to label everybody, you know. Because it's not good. It's not going to be good for the country. They're taking away their total liberty, you could say. And everything is becoming panopticon-ish, you could say, where they'll be able to look and see what you're doing, see. But the police are still firing tear gas and water cannons. And it says here they're pushing for Macron must resign over in France. So, yeah. Okay, Macron, what are you doing then, huh? You're for the Brussels. You're for the big European Union. You don't give a damn about Frenchmen. And the French are out there wearing their yellow vests saying, hey, we've had it, man, with this centralized government. And we've had it with you, Macron, and you need to resign. And he'd been put up by the Rothschilds and all that big money power anyway. So that's what we're up against today. These populist movements, whether they're in Hungary or other countries throughout Europe, there was one in Spain a while back. They're being characterized as some totalitarian type of out of control, and the people don't know what they're doing, and they're populist or they're nationalist. And if you're a nationalist, then you're going to behave just like Hitler or Mussolini or something like that. There are nationalists all across the spectrum of political thought, from the left all the way to the right. So it's not just that the populists are right-wing people, you know. What you're seeing is you're seeing a revolt from we the people. They're revolting. And they're revolting against these elitists that have had them under their thumb with money power and interest paying and all these taxes for years. These taxes now, just like in these gasoline taxes in France. The people are standing up and saying, hey, we have had it, Macron. We want you to resign, see. And so we're sick and tired of this thing. And people are going to force change. They're out in the streets in Paris, in France. And they've let the Muslims overrun Europe. That's part of the reaction. And all of a sudden, Hillary wakes up and says, oh, I think the Muslims in Europe are causing people to go with nationalist, populist movements, you know. Yeah, yeah, she's just falling, you know, in line now. She didn't say that when she was on the campaign trail, see. But, and that's why, if you listen to this earlier in this hour, to Steve Bannon, he said that what's dangerous right now, and this is what's dangerous for President Trump, is that they know now that he's against them. He's against the system, the elite system that's been, you could say, built up over the last century, since 1913, you could say, in the United States, when they took over our Federal Reserve and created this privately owned Federal Reserve system. Then they began to dominate business through that lending power, that money power. And the City of London was right there with them, and as part as these foreign interests that were owning the Fed along with the American interest. So what we got there was just a tremendous, you could say, dominance system of money power and dominance. And it resulted in men and businesses being controlled by those elites that control the banking industry. So we're going to see more and more riots and protest movements. And, you know, it could be that a friend of mine used to say that the European Union was finished because of the language and customs and the culture and things like that were so different in those countries. Now, Bannon was saying he's been talking to people all over Europe, and they're saying that they don't want to destroy the European Union, but they want to reform it, and what they want is more say within their own countries. And what I've always said before was that when they started trying to monopolize the European Union with one currency, I think that's when they went wrong, because what they want to do was bring all those countries under one central bank, a European central bank with one currency, and then they would be the ones at the center of that. They could control the credit creation and so forth, and take away, you could say, the nation state leadership's power over those respective European Union countries. So that's what I see was the end run around the nation state in Europe, was to create this monetary unit, and then use that monetary unit to as a vehicle through a one central bank of all of European Union to dominate and to create credit for a very, very elite cream de la cream group in Europe. And I see that now some of those national leaders in those countries are beginning to say, hey, I've lost my power and my money rights and my borrowing rights at our national banks that we used to have our own central, you could say, bank. And so I'm not as credit worthy now under this new system. I don't have the power, the money power that I had before, and I want to go back to the nation state and with a nation state type of central bank controlled by me and my buddies, not this European Union gang, see. Now, here lately, though, you've had May try to go in there, Prime Minister May, with some kind of an agreement with the European Union on this Brexit. But this, what's been uncovered now is that agreement was one way that favored the European Union and still put the UK under a lot of control and manipulation and dominance of the European Union. So you've got Boris Johnson and all those other people in Parliament now with their raising holy hell with Theresa May. And her time to be Prime Minister is about to come to an end because of the scandal now. So what's going to happen next is that you're going to see the UK break off and form their own trade alliances with the West, with the United States, and so forth. So actually, you know, Bannon in this earlier speech this hour said that the Oxford Union, he said that Trump wants to make this playing field level, see, and the trade was not properly favoring the United States. It was totally against us. And so they took all these jobs and deindustrialized the United States, and Trump is trying to reindustrialize and bring higher paying jobs back to the United States. And that's why this internationalist, these globalists don't want it. They had it all set up, see, with Hillary and everybody else. And they didn't, and Hillary was going along with their wishes and what they wanted to do. And now you've got Trump in there like a loose cannon, and he cares about the country, thank goodness. And they don't, and so it's obvious who we have to go with. But what I see here lately is the propaganda machine that they have is highly effective. And so all this media hype, all these cable companies they still own, and all the major networks and all these movies and all this propaganda that they're able to control is still very, very powerful. And so we're not winning the propaganda war that I see right now. And we're losing the culture wars to a very progressive, very ultra-liberal, leftist collective, you could say communist left. Marxist, communist, socialist left is basically what we're losing the culture war to. And they don't talk about crony capitalism, but Steve Bannon does in his speech to the Oxford Union. He talked about crony capitalism. And so he knows what's going on, and Trump knows what's going on. And he's trying to give us a fairer shape. But he's got a past and willy-dilly and stuff. But I want to thank everybody for listening out there. George Butler, along with Charlotte Littlefield Brown, been broadcasting for a little over 12 years on thesecrettruth.com every Saturday night, 7 to 9. Our first hour is usually fresh, and the second one is usually a broadcast. But tune us in every Saturday night at thesecrettruth.com. Thank you for listening, and good night, and God bless each and every one of you out there. So good night. Bye-bye.